Hi, I am Gus Lorenz, and I'm here today to talk to you about this neonicotinoid issue that we have with honeybees in the Mid-South. I have to recognize my co-authors up there, particularly Angus and Scott and Jeff here up on the podium. This was something that we felt like back around 2011 when we started seeing all the reports on neonicotinoids and the impact that they were making on bee health and all the accusations that were going on out there. There's a war going on out there, folks. And the neonicotinoids have caught a lot of bad press. And it's got to the point where we have to be, as decision makers for our growers in the Mid-South, we need to start looking and deciding where we stand and what we can do to maintain and preserve this class of chemistry. And it's not just this class of chemistry, it's also like Transform that just came on the market. There's a battle out there right now. There's a lawsuit going on at this point. They're trying to take Transform back from us. And we all know what those issues are that we have out there in not only in cotton production, but across the crops in the Mid-South, and how important this class of chemistry and the new chemistry can be to us. And if we don't start standing up and doing what we can to maintain these products, I don't know about you, but I don't want to try to fight plant bugs without the neonicotinoids. I don't want to try to maintain plant bug control without Transform. I don't think we can. I think it would be extremely difficult for us to do that. And if you're unaware of how bad this situation is, then get on the internet and look at some of this stuff that's out there. And we're going to address these issues today. And this is not like when we got involved, this group up here on the podium and a lot of other folks out there, graduate students and technicians and everybody that we had working on these project, it's not like a plant bug trial or a thrips trial. You know, I'm going to show you a lot of numbers today. What do those numbers mean? When you look at the literature out there, it's really hard for us to determine how big an issue when we're looking at parts per billion of a neonicotinoid. It's really difficult for us to translate that into what it means to the honeybees. Okay? So as we go through this, you're going to see a lot of numbers and just realize that as we get into this, you know, the questions still arise about that impact and what we're seeing and how much that is playing on bee health, and the different ways that when we go through this, you're going to see a lot of numbers, and we're going to try to explain to you what the positives are and what the negatives are of what we've seen in our work with the honeybees in the Mid-South and the neonicotinoid issue out there. Okay, so if you look at the internet, there's a lot of websites out there that are telling you that neonics are the main reason that bees are dying. This hive collapse disorder issue that's out there with the bee health declining, a lot of people have decided that it's strictly an insecticide issue. Whether that's true or not, there's a lot of argument on that. So the only problem is, we got a problem with meeting world demand for food supply. What they tell us is we're going to have to double our production by the year 2050. So it seems like we need everything in the toolkit that we can get to maintain and increase our yields across all the crops that we have. So to do that, we need to maintain those classes of chemistry like the neonicotinoids as much as possible. Jeff's going to come up after I get through and talk about the value of neonicotinoids in the Mid-South and what they mean to us. But certainly, the overriding issue for me is If we're going to meet that demand to feed the people in this world, we need all the help we can get to get there. So when we started this project, we started talking in 2011. We're seeing the internet, we're seeing CNN, we're seeing the news, and it's bad. It's a bad situation. There's a lot of bad press out there about insecticides and the impact that they're making. So this group of folks got together, and it's quite a crew that you see up there that were involved in all these studies that we did. And we'll get into that in just a second, but I just want to recognize everybody up there that was a part of the studies that we've conducted up to now. You can see all those names. I'm not going to mention them independently. So let's address what our objectives were when we started this project. And the first one was to assess the carryover in crop soil of the neonicotinoids pre-plant, and then also to determine the residue in the soil from soil where we planted insecticide seed treats. We went out in multiple crops, cotton, soybeans, and corn were the three big ones that we went with. And we took soil samples out there prior to planting. Guess what? We found neonicotinoids out there. They were already in the soil before we planted our plots. So that tells me that we're getting some carryover. There is some residue out there from neonicotinoids in the soil. And you can see to the percentage there, I've highlighted that one there that says percent detections in parts per billion greater than one. And you can see 79% of the pre-plant samples that we took had neonicotinoids in them, which indicates there is some carryover of neonicotinoids in the soil. After we planted our plots, we looked at the number of parts per billion that we were seeing in the different crops across our trials. And you can see in corn, cotton, and soybeans, the numbers range from 0 up to 658 parts per billion. In cotton, the average, you can see the average. Those average numbers are kind of low. 4.8 for corn, 31.6 for cotton. You can see the number of samples. I would indicate to you that at this point that of all the studies that have been conducted out there in the Mid-South or in the world, looking at this kind of issue, I think we've probably got about as big a data set as anybody anywhere. So it's pretty much the situation that we got. This is in pre-plant soils. So we got those concentrations, and you can see the percentage out there in the yellow bars, the percent detections over one part per billion in the different crops, and you can see those numbers are kind of high, 63% in soybeans and 98% in cotton. Now the question is, we know they're there, we're picking them up, sure enough, but the question is, how does that impact bees? How is that going to impact bee health? So when we look at the literature and the internet, what it says is neonics applied as seed treatment are then taken up through the plant and are expressed in the pollen, the nectar, and the gutation droplets out there. That's what everybody's telling us. That's the indication that's out there, and that's the press that we get. Well, that's not so much what we found when we did our trials. What we did see was this is in corn pollen, and we felt like we had, out of all the trials that we did, we had six that were positive, and you can see the range there, 0 to 23 parts per billion. But the mean is about 2.3. You see imidacloprid, 0. Thymethoxam, really low. So we're not seeing that expression of that material in the corn pollen, okay? Now, when we look at cotton pollen, it's even better. We're not seeing that expression of the neonics in the cotton pollen. Very low percentage, very low numbers that you see there. The mean is 0.167 parts per billion. Very low. We tested soybean flours. You don't see anything there. So the neonicotinoids are not expressed, based on our data, in the flour of the soybean. We looked at cotton nectar. You know, that was part of the issue there, the nectar, it's showing up in the nectar. What we found was it's not expressed in the nectar. It's not there at bloom. So what we did was we took the material from the extra floral nectary, the floral nectary on the plant, took the material, had it tested, and it's not showing up. It's not there. So it's not being expressed in the reproductive parts of the plant so much. The second objective was for us, and you know, when we started this study, you know, what we were hearing was that there were these huge clouds of neonicotinoid dust floating across the landscape at planting time, and we kind of laughed that off. We really didn't feel like there was anything there, but we wanted to test it. And so we looked at wildflowers, and based on the planter dust that's coming out, that's what the issue was. How big an issue is planter dust when we're planting neonicotinoid treated seed? So in 2012, we took samples of flowers on the edges of fields where we had planted neonicotinoids, and tried to stay within a 7-day range and usually within 3 days, and took those samples that you see. And we went in the cardinal directions and we sampled that way in 2012. And you can see the mean range from the field that we did, about 20 meters up to 225 meters. We took a lot of samples, 78 samples, 49 fields, a pretty extensive study. We looked at a lot of different types of wildflowers out there. You can see there the range of plants that we were looking at in our study. And this is what we found. We found that percent detections ranged about 23%. So there is some neonicotinoid dust floating across that landscape. It is out there. It does occur. And so based on our 2012 information, we expanded this part of our study for 2013. And this is some of Scott Stewart's data from Tennessee. And you can see the thimethoxam concentration in parts per billion across distances, minus 5, 5, 20, 50, and on out. And looking at the concentration of thimethoxam that we're picking up on wildflowers on the edges of fields, and you can see obviously what you would expect downwind distance as you move away from the field. It definitely falls off, but certainly we are picking it up, you know, even out to 100 meters there. So there is some neonicotinoids floating out there when we plant. This is a study that we did. We maintained the wildflowers and went out and got on just the downwind side, just like Scott did in his study that I showed in the previous slide, but we were collecting wildflowers instead of potted plant deals. And what we found was cotton wildflowers, about in cotton, the wildflowers, about 75% of them detected some neonicotinoid, and it dropped off for soybeans and corn, as you see there. But certainly the detection is there. We're picking up some level of neonics when you plant. That dust that's coming out the bottom of that planter and coming from the planter is definitely floating across the landscape a little bit more than what we thought. Angus's crew, he had a graduate student, Adam Whalen, that did some work looking at drift and deposition of neonicotinoids with the different kinds of seed lubricants, and had some really interesting data. They were looking at the impact of talc versus graphite in an experimental product that they're looking at, and looking at and doing the same thing kind of that Scott was doing with the plants. I think y'all used marigolds, isn't that right? So potted some flats of marigolds that they set at distances from the planter. And this is what they saw as overall detection by distance. You can see from zero to out to 100 meters there that we are picking up some neonicotinoids, and you can see how it falls off and then goes back up, which is an indication to us that wind currents can have a huge impact on that deposition downwind. And a lot of times in our study that we did, we would see greater concentrations out at 50 or 100 meters than we did at 25, indicating the importance of wind in that situation and how it can impact those neonicotinoids floating across the landscape. This is looking at the different lubricants that he put in with the seed, and you can see not a whole lot of difference between talc and graphite, but it looks like the experimental definitely brought something to the table compared to the talc. And this is part of this mitigation issue. You know, we realize now that there is a dust issue with the planter, and we need to start looking at some ways to reduce that neonicotinoid drift across the landscape with these when we use insecticide treated seed. So there are some issues there that we need to deal with, and I think that's nothing that we can't fix with some engineering and some additional products that maybe can help us reduce that neonicotinoid dust. So you can see the conclusions that Angus's crew came up with. Certainly, lubricant can have, the lubricant that the grower uses can have a significant impact out there. That wind is a big issue, and how the wind blows and how far that neonicotinoid drifts across the landscape can be big. The important thing is just like I've already mentioned, you know, the toxicity of the parts per billion and what that really means out there is the question that we're all trying to get to. You know, the hazard that it brings to the honeybees and to the other pollinators out there. The question is, how do you take that toxicant and that risk and reduce it as much as possible? So the last part of our study that we did was to evaluate the apiaries, you know, look at the bees themselves and collect pollen from the bees and look at that, how much residue we're picking up on those bees that are coming back to the hive. So we did that, and this is just a visual of sampling the bees. You see the bee sucker? That's what we call that thing, so they can suck up the bees, and we can take the samples and look at them and take, you see the pollen on that bee on the right? We take that pollen off and sample it too. What we found in that situation, and this is just a kind of a indication of the locations where we took our data, and you can see where the apiary is. This is in Deschaux County. This is one that Scott had in Fayette County, and you can see the mixture of crops around where we did this. We tried to collect our data in intensive agriculture areas so we could determine how much impact the neonicotinoids were making on those hives around intensive ag areas. So we collect the bees, we separate the pollen. As you can see on the right there, we're removing the pollen from the pollen basket on the honeybee and collecting it and sampling it individually from the bee. So this is what we found in that study. You're seeing total detections there. We had one detection with clothianidin, one with imidacloprid, a couple with thymethoxam, for a total of all the bees that we sampled in this study and all the apiaries, which is about 74 total beehives. We did find bees on a few of the samples. We found the neonicotinoid on the bees on a few samples. You see the percent detection greater than one part per billion is less than 3% across the study. Pretty low level. This is looking at the bee pollen itself that we collected from the bees when they returned to the hive. And you can see again how low the numbers are for detection with neonics. it pretty much indicates to me that we're not really, as far as seed treatments are concerned, we're really not hurting those bees or harming them to any great extent with the neonicotinoid seed treatments. So pretty low levels of concentration in the bee pollen. And just to give you some perspective, you know, the detection of neonicotinoids in the soil, it tells us that, yeah, it's out there. Neonicotinoids do have a longevity in the soil that can go over time. But what does that mean to the bees? I'm not thinking that based on our information that we've been able to gather at this point, you know, that level of neonicotinoids in the soil is translating to bee health or bee concerns, because it's not translocating to the reproductive parts of the plant. So we're not as concerned about, as far as bee health is concerned, about those neonics in the soil. We know that they're metabolizing based on what we saw in our studies. The numbers go down with time, but they are long-lived in the soil. And to me, that's not as big an issue as it's been made to be. Scott did a study where he looked at, he treated seed with Evicta and immediately had it analyzed, and you can see the parts per billion down there of the concentration. If I took treated seed and had it analyzed and compared that to the numbers that you have seen today, 435,000 parts per billion, that's a lot. That sounds like a big number. And when you compare it to the numbers that I've shown you now today, the parts per billion are pretty low. So in perspective, it appears that to me that impact of the neonicotinoids based on the insecticide seed treatments is really not as great as what is perceived out there in the public. So based on our information up to now, in summary, what I'd tell you is that the neonicotinoids are out there. We're picking them up in the soil. We're picking up low levels in pollen, in corn a little bit, maybe. But overall, when you look at cotton nectar, cotton pollen, soybean flowers, we're not expressing that neonicotinoid in those reproductive parts of the plant. We are seeing that movement with planting. There is some neonicotinoid contamination out there. I think that can be mitigated with a little bit of work on everybody's part. Finding some ways to reduce that issue with dust is going to be a big thing. But basically, the cotton pollen, the cotton nectar, and the soybean flowers are all free pretty much of neonicotinoids. There's a lot of, when we got into this study and we started doing it, we didn't realize the magnitude and how much it was going to take to run this study. And we thought we had it all figured out, but when we got into it and we found out that the price of a single sample, was $165 a sample, isn't that right? Yeah, $160, $170 a sample. So in Arkansas alone, in 2012, we had about 650, 700 samples. You multiply that by $165, $170, we realized real quick we needed some help to cover the cost of this study because of the magnitude of the study and the number of samples that we had. So it took a lot of people. We had to go out and beg for money, the three of us, and you can see the list of people that stood up and helped us when we needed it the most to find out what the impact of these neonicotinoids were out there and what they were doing, you know, to the bee health. You know, as extension entomologists, all of us up here, we got to protect the bees. That's an issue. We need to do everything we can to maintain bee health as much as possible. We know how important bees are to the landscape and how important they are to our growers and that kind of thing. But at the same time, you know, we need to protect our industry too, our row crop industry, and that's kind of what we're trying to do here. And you can see the folks that stepped up and helped us meet the need out there at that point to make it all work out. And we couldn't have done it without the help of everybody up there on that list. It just wouldn't have happened. We didn't have the finances to carry out a study of this magnitude without them. So I want to recognize everybody on that list for everything they did. And with that, Angus, I'll take questions if anybody's got anything. Yes, sir.
Gus, thanks for that extensive work. Great to see that you all are working so hard on it.
Sure.
Can you tell us, you know offhand what the QLE50s are of some of these neonics or transform on bees, and whether, especially the transform, whether it's been some chronic exposure? I imagine much more extensive data than we used to do with honeybees when the neonics first came out. Can you give us a magnitude there?
Yeah, the question is, can we state what the LD50s are and what those toxic concentrations are and how that translates from the data that you see up here to what impact that makes on the bees? And we have struggled with that. That's been one of the sticking points for us, is to take the data that we've accumulated up to now and to try to, and when you look at the literature out there, it's really difficult to come up with a true, what I would consider a good LD50. We've all looked at it. Angus has probably looked at it as much as anybody. Angus, you got any comments on that?
Is this on? Y'all hear me? Yeah. I can't remember the number. The number, we've seen the number for cefoxiflor, but I just cannot remember what it is. I think for some of the neonics, depending on the one, it ranges, but acute toxicity was somewhere around, I don't want to speculate right now. I can't remember. The number exists for cefoxiflor. We've seen the data from Dow, but I can't remember what it is.
But when you get into and the issue, you know, that as far as a lethal dose, and if you look at the current literature that's out there, you know, the bee folks and the folks that are concerned about bee health and the issue of the neonicotinoids, they've kind of got away from the lethal dose part of it, and they're starting to look at the impact of that neonicotinoid and the impact that it makes on bee health. And how that, they're looking at some pathogens that express themselves more in bees that are contaminated with neonicotinoids. So we're kind of in a state of flux there, and they've kind of transferred their emphasis not so much on lethal doses as they have on chronic health of the bee. And so that's all in a state of flux as far as I'm concerned, based on the literature that I've read and the research that's been done. There's no clear pattern, and there's no clear, to me, we really don't know. We don't know what, but we do know, you know, the important thing that I take out of this study is that the translocation of these seed treatment materials is not going to the reproductive parts of the plant, which the bee is going to visit. That's the important part for me. The take-home message is, to me, out of all this, is that we need to mitigate the dust issue. We need to take care of that. We need to find some solutions when we plant these products, that we're not putting dust out in the landscape and causing problems that way. But at the same time, once we get it in the seed, in the ground, It's protecting the plant and providing what it needs to the plant without transferring to the reproductive parts of the plant. Okay?
Yes, I'll comment just a little bit. My memory, I'm a little afraid to give you a number, but I'm thinking that those LD50s for acute are around the 200 parts per billion range, and it varies. And actually, some of our higher numbers, like on the wildfires, the maximum numbers would have been there. The real question is, you start with bees, you're storing food, you're storing pollen, you have chronic exposure, and they're not always just going to be feeding on that source, and that's the real challenge, and actually that's some of the next steps we're all taking. We're starting to actually work on bees and bee health and trying to get some perspective here. So we are continuing this work.